This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Shares of Mattel are trading lower today, down more than 6% after the company said second quarter margins shrank due to inflation, higher supply chain costs, and royalty expenses. CEO Ynon Kreiz was on with our Bloomberg TV crew earlier, and they talked about how the company, though, did keep their forecast intact.
Ynon Kreiz is chairman and CEO of Mattel. He joins us on the phone from California right now. Ynon, great to have you back with us. How are you?
Hi, Tim. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Great to be here.
Well, bring us into the most recent quarter and what you're expecting for the rest of 2022, because when we've been able to talk to you over the last few months, you've been really confident that you can manage the supply chain challenges in the inflationary environment that we find ourselves in right now.
That's right. So first of all, on the quarter that we just completed, these were excellent results for Mattel with our eighth consecutive quarter of top-line growth. Our profits also grew significantly, with adjusted operating income up 82%, despite high inflation. And following a record first half, we expect to continue growing in the second half and are planning for increase in consumer demand in the holiday season. So all in all, we're very happy with the position we are in. We expect to win market share going forward, and we reiterated full-year guidance for strong top-line growth, increased profitability, a higher gross margin, and all of this is in spite of significant inflation and negative currency impact.
So are you like, come on, investors, you so got it wrong?
Look, we are very focused on managing the company. We have been growing now consistently. We're executing on our strategy. We have, you know, we won market share for 2 years in a row, and we expect to win market share this year as well. Our supply chain is in very good shape. All of our owned and operated factories are fully operational. Product is flowing in. We're expecting a second half retail sales to be above the first half levels. We're seeing the industry growing as well.
Well, so Ynon, what happened? Because one of the things that we, Tim and I, have always, after we talk with you, we're kind of blown away by your ability to be flexible with supply chains, move them ahead of kind of some of the constraints that we've seen in the last couple of years, and manage it really, really well. So what happened in the last quarter? Because I think it's safe to say that what is freaking out investors, and it's been a top theme for all of us here at Bloomberg, is what's happening with margins. What happened that your margins shrunk that maybe even caught you guys by surprise?
No, the margin impact was expected. It was factored into our guidance. We talked about it at the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, it's getting better, actually, because we did revise our guidance on gross margin, not by much, but nevertheless, a positive uplift. We're able to offset negative currency impact and maintain and reiterate our guidance for the full year. So the margin reduction was very much expected and as I said, you know, factored into our guidance in the beginning of the year. Over time, we do expect that the combination of pricing and cost savings will more than exceed the impact of inflation and contribute to margin expansion. And we do expect that, we do expect inflation to moderate in 2023. But, you know, we also reiterated our goals for 2023, where we talk about high single-digit growth in constant currency, adjusted operating income margin of 16 to 17%, and continue to grow our earnings per share and exceed $1.90. Mm. We're staying the course.
Okay.
Continue to execute our strategy and seeing it in the numbers.
Give me an idea of what you're seeing with pricing power right now. Where are you able to raise prices so that consumers will continue to pay but you can better cover increasing costs on your side without destructing demand.
Yes, pricing is one of the options we consider in times of inflation. This is not obviously unique to Mattel or unique to the toy industry. But we've said before, and we're being very consistent about it, is that when we raise prices, we always keep consumers in mind. We're being very thoughtful and strategic and are committed to maintaining the highest quality and best value for consumers. We haven't seen any negative impact from the pricing actions we took last year. We just took another action that will become be factored into our numbers in the second half, and this is something that we previously announced, so this is not new news, and we haven't seen a negative impact. The these actions are very methodical and thought through.
So, what's selling? I know in our Bloomberg story that you guys, I think, said on the conference call last night that you guys were seeing some softness in sales of higher-priced items, such as a Barbie Dream House, I think, which costs around $200, having owned one when I was younger. But anyway, so what is selling? What is not? Where are you seeing maybe some consumer sensitivity because of the overall inflationary environment?
Well, in the second quarter, we saw comprehensive growth. 24% in constant currency. We were up in double digits, strong double digits in North America, EMEA, and Latin America. We grew in all of our reported categories and in our three power brands, Barbie, Hot Wheels, and Fisher-Price. So the performance was pretty comprehensive with some really strong numbers. We did say that Hot Wheels, as an example, is on track to achieve its fifth record year in a row. Barbie is just coming off an all-time high in 2021, and we said that we expect to be sales for Barbie to be comparable, so we're holding a very high bar.
Right.
And all in all, we are pretty strong performance across the board.
So we were talking about the Barbie movie on the call, and I know we've talked with that for you before. I think for what I understand is that it's wrapped in terms of principal photography. What we've been wondering, and I'm going to steal a question that actually Tim brought up on our call, but he said, you know, the point of, do you anticipate making more money from the movie and your partnership on the Barbie movie, or more from the lift that the Barbie brand gets thanks to the movie?
No, we absolutely see this opportunity as incremental to our toy business. Our strategy to capture the full value of our IP is about participating in highly accretive business verticals that are adjacent to the toy industry and are also driven by big franchises and big brands, but we want them and expect them to be accretive in and of themselves. So the partnership, or the Barbie movie and the partnership that we have with Warner Brothers is such that we have a meaningful economic participation in the Barbie movie, as well as, for that matter, all of our movie projects. We do have economic participation, and of course we understand that in success there will be a benefit for the toy business. But we do expect economic participation outside of the toy aisle as well.
What does meaningful economic participation mean? Does that mean that Mattel's a producer of the movie and you're putting money into the movie, or does it mean that you get a percentage of ticket sales?
Yeah, it's different types of participations. But we do not fund the movie. We do not participate in movie financing. This is not our expertise and not our business, but we do participate economically, both as the IP owner, as the owner of the brand, and as a producer. We are producer on all of our projects.
Do you get a piece of the box office, Enon?
We haven't been specific on the commercial terms, but box office and receipts are part of the equation. Typical
right.
participants.
Hey, can we talk to you about SpaceX? We've been talking about this story all week long. Tell us about the collaboration. It's a multi-year agreement that Mattel has announced with SpaceX to produce toys and collectibles.
Yeah, this is an exciting partnership to create space exploration toys and collectibles under the Matchbox brand. The toys will come out next year. The collectible toys will be available on Mattel Creation, our direct-to-consumer site. And this is really about, you know, scaling our portfolio. It's about innovation. It's about thinking out of the box and bringing new partners to the toy aisle. And this was one that people were, you know, didn't expect and didn't see coming. And it is exciting because we are partnering with an exciting company in an exciting area. But, you know, more than this partnership specifically, it is about how we continue to scale our portfolio and work to position Mattel as a partner of choice for major IP owners.
Is there going to be an Elon Musk action figure?
That's what I want to know.
it's obviously this, you know, we don't go into that level of resolution on the product side, but we always look to continue to innovate and delight our consumers and do it in fun and creative ways.
I would imagine there is demand for that, so I guess we'll have to wait and see, Enon.
I would buy an Elon doll. I just think that would be kind of fun. Enon, thank you so much. Once again, just giving us a nice chunk of time and really leaning into the business and letting us know what's going on. Enon Kreiz, he is the chairman and chief executive officer of Mattel. Mattel shares under pressure, but as we mentioned, they are still up for the year here in 2022.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The new issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine out on newsstands, online, and of course on the Bloomberg terminal. And in it is a story about the AI platform behind a Jeff Bezos-backed startup's vegan burger. So I feel like, Tim, that there are so many big macro themes of the day in this story.
You said Big Mac, which kind of makes sense.
Did I say Big Mac?
Big macro.
Did I?
I heard, you know, so I hear Big Mac in there because I'm always thinking about food.
He's always hungry.
Augusta Sariva is supply chain reporter for Bloomberg News. She's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Augusta, good to have you with us. What is this AI platform with Not Company SA?
Thank you for having me on. And it's interesting that you said Big Mac because they actually have a big deal with Burger King. But this company is actually a Chilean startup.
Wait, is it Big Mac McDonald's or Burger King?
Big Mac is McDonald's, Whopper is Burger King.
But I can't keep it. But they're
kind of the counterparts of the restaurant. You got to know your burgers, Carol.
All right. There's too many
But
choices.
That's the point. These are not burgers. They're not burgers. Literally, they're made out of potato chips. They're made out of sunflower oil. Everything that you would not expect to see on a burger is there.
Okay, the problem though is sunflower oil, a little hard to come by these days.
Yes, and when you're making alternatives to burgers, that's extremely needed because it goes on a third of all of the alternative burgers out there. And because of the war in Ukraine and because all of the supply chain shortages we've been hearing about over the past year, it's been hard to find. So what this company did, I mean, since they were already creating alternatives to everything, they just decided to make alternatives to the alternatives, right? So that's how they came up with the idea.
And how does it work? Is it good? And does it taste right? Or what, like...
Well, that's the point. They just started trying it out. And if it works out, that's the plan. They want to sort of like revolutionize the industry. But right now, what they're doing is that they're using the algorithm, which they call Giuseppe. It's sort of a nickname. And they're trying to use that to create...
I'm thinking somebody was in a lab. There was a little, I don't know, tequila going around. And they're like, what are we going to call this thing? Giuseppe.
Yeah.
Or is there a reason behind it?
There is a reason behind. It's based on an Italian painter that would only paint using vegetables.
Ah.
So that's why. There is a reason. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm also imagining in my head like a little robot that kind of goes in and tastes things and thinks to itself, okay, this is what could be a meaningful alternative. But we're just talking about algorithms instead of computer, right?
Yeah, in a way. It's just a computer, but it sort of scans the product and then it breaks everything down. Either if it's a recipe or if it's an ingredient.
What do you mean by scans the product?
So it looks at, let's say, a lettuce leaf. And it's like, so what's here? What are the molecules? What is everything mm-hmm. that is here? So that they look at that and then they're like, how can I recreate that using different things? Maybe lettuce wasn't the best example because we don't actually need vegan alternatives to that. But maybe if you look at a burger, how do you take the animal out of the equation? Mm. So that's what the algorithm does.
I keep thinking of like this incredible whiteboard or something, right? Like, and here's what the traditional thing is. And what are some things that we can use to substitute that maybe give it the same kick nutritionally? Or because the bigger story here, and this is why I get to the Big Mac story, the big macro story, is we are looking at a world that is getting maxed out. And how do we don't feed the people that are currently on this earth. So how do we do it in the face of things like climate change that are really shifting where we traditionally farm and so on? So it's like, how do we do this? And this is maybe part of the solution.
Yeah, and that's exactly how NACO was born. They were born not only to create alternatives, so it's not like oat milk that actually doesn't taste anything like milk, right? Their goal is to make alternatives that are good for the climate, that are good for people who do not eat meat, who try to avoid that, but they also want their products to taste like the real ones. So their milk, if you go and try them, it's made out of pineapple juice, but still it tastes like actual milk.
It's pretty amazing that they're able to do that. Augusta, I'm wondering about competitors in this space. We talk a lot about Beyond Meat. It's a publicly traded company. The stock has been under a ton of pressure. We just had Dina Shanker on our program yesterday talking about the challenges that they're having with pepperoni. And then, of course, Impossible Foods, which is still privately held. They sort of have their, you know, secret recipes to try to replicate what the taste of a burger or animal protein is. Is this like a secret, not a secret recipe, but is this like a secret sauce for this company, this algorithm to try to replicate?
It is indeed. And that's the point. It's a private company. So at this point, we don't really know where they're going with that.
Right.
They actually had plans to go public next year, but with all the headwinds, that might not be the case. But as of now, yes, that's their secret ingredient, right? Their Big Mac sauce.
It's kind of the next step when we keep thinking about. It's so funny. We were talking about Beyond Meat this week. And like when it first came on the scene, it was like, okay, this is the answer, right, to feeding the world. But this actually takes a much bigger picture, right, and looks at all the elements and things. And like, how do we kind of figure out alternatives?
Right.
Is that fair?
Yes, it is fair. And that's what they're saying. They don't want to only revolutionize the one product. They want to revolutionize the industry. So maybe one day we're going to see that algorithm, that juice app, becoming the norm in the industry, but not right now.
Yeah, exactly. It's got some big money behind it, right? We talked about Jeff Bezos is behind it, Danny Meyer, and a few others.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about taste. I'm wondering about being able to do this on a mass scale. Carol alluded to the challenges with feeding the world in a previous comment to you, Augusta. And I'm wondering how we do this in a way that solves the problems that we're seeing right now. Not just hunger, but of course, climate change and the emissions that are associated with raising animals.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons why we decided to take the supply chain angle for this story, right? Because with everything that is going on nowadays, the disruptions, the war in Ukraine, it's so hard to find alternatives. And at the same time, you have so much hunger going on. And when you think of even the alternatives, right, even oat milk, the production of that, it takes so much water to produce. Mm-hmm. So even when you think about
and
the alternatives.
Almond milk too?
Yes.
Because almonds use so much water.
I feel guilty because I love my Oatly.
Yes, I do too. So that's the point, right? Can we ever get this right? And I think that's what this company is trying to do, create an alternative that is good, that is fair, and that doesn't take a lot out of us.
Well, and if you could start to compare like A from B from C from D in terms of different ways of either producing things and food, the impact on the climate, like you can kind of figure out which is the most sustainable way and also, you know, meeting the goals of feeding the world, if you will. Augusta Saraiva, she is supply chain reporter here at Bloomberg News. I love that we have a supply chain reporter. So relevant.
And she's just awesome. She got to be on our team at Quick Take for a few months as a rotator. And we miss you, Augusta.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
A lot going on in the world of crypto. And what was interesting is we are seeing in some ways over the past 10 days, investors scooping up about $1 billion worth of crypto exposed companies. This is according to a report we published on Wednesday by VandaTrack. So they were buying things, Tim, like Marathon Digital, Coinbase Global, Riot Blockchain. I mean, after the carnage, people are finding some opportunities.
At the same time, Carol, we're starting to see some legal action taken against people. Three have been charged in the first ever cryptocurrency insider trading tipping scheme. To get some information on this and more when it comes to crypto, we turn to Kathy Kraninger. She is former director of the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau, also vice president of regulatory affairs at Solace Labs. Kathy, great to have you back with us, joining us once again from Washington, D.C. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me back. It's definitely a busy time in crypto.
Yeah, like it really is. Well, I want to start with this Coinbase news that three have been charged in the first ever cryptocurrency insider trading tipping scheme here. Are we going to start to see more legal action taken against those in the crypto industry?
Well, this just demonstrates that this industry is, in fact, obviously regulated and subject to the law. And as was said by the U.S. attorney, fraud is fraud. So the indictments are fairly clear. Obviously, we'll see how the case carries out. But it is critical to see rules be enforced. And I'd also note that you see in the indictment that Coinbase had policies in place and was, in fact, monitoring the behavior of their employees, which, again, is what a responsible market participant would do and what you would hope and expect from them. So I think, again, it just demonstrates that there are responsible actors in this space and that the people who are engaged in wrongdoing and fraud should, in fact, face prosecution.
Is there a silver lining to this in that it shows that the industry is growing up and it's essentially on solid footing in the sense that regulators are taking it seriously?
No, I think that's true. You see definitely a maturation process, regulators understanding the industry better. But as I said, if you go back to the lesson here, I think it really is, fraud is fraud no matter where it happens. And that's something that I think is important. There are absolutely new and novel things about digital asset markets and ways that we need to, tailor things to make sure that you're treating, like activities in a like way from a regulation standpoint. But some of these things certainly are things that you see across the board wherever there is an opportunity to make money and where people see an opportunity to, unfairly take advantage of others.
I feel like it's not a new problem. We've heard this before. Kathy, all right. So three charge in the first ever cryptocurrency insider trading, one of the most read stories on the Bloomberg. It's an exclusive, and it talks about the Three Arrow founders.
Huge, huge story.
Huge story. Once high-flying hedge funds saying that their bungled crypto speculation unleashed cascading margin calls on loans that should never have been made. So as more things continue to come out in different ways, but showing continued carnage, if you will, in different ways in the crypto world, what are the key problems, the key vulnerabilities in the crypto world, in your view, that need to be tackled by regulators?
So there are definitely things, as I noted, that make this space more unique and areas where there needs to be some more conversation. I think the Lummis-Gillibrand bill certainly is an attempt at getting to some of those gaps in a more comprehensive treatment in the U.S. And there are other bills, too. Obviously, Senators Stabenow and Bozeman are about to introduce something. And you've got the House bills, too, where there's a lot of activity and even an imminent stablecoin regime perhaps coming. And so, that's all positive to see that bipartisan activity. Now, again, whether
there's something like 50 digital asset bills, out there or something. I mean, if you had to pick one or two things that you're like, okay, this is what we've got to get down in order for this industry to really kind of grow legitimately and comfortably and securely.
One of them is definitely, the way we talk about it, the taxonomy, the terminology. Stable coins, of course, imply that they are stable, and that certainly implies backing and reserve. And so that's a conversation that obviously the stablecoin bill will seek to address, and where clearly new authority needs to be granted to agencies in terms of and requirements around that. That really Congress is best placed to act on. I guess that's one example I would provide.
So help us play that out and what that would look like, Kathy, because I've been thinking a lot about stable coins because of the collapse of Terra. And I'm wondering if a bill would basically say, okay, well, this type of stable coin is allowed, maybe one that uses cash or commercial paper or cash equivalents in terms of like what people pull out of tokens. There's that an equal amount of money backing it up in a safe somewhere, on a balance sheet somewhere. But maybe the algorithmic stablecoin, that's not okay?
So I am definitely not going to get into the weeds on that because I think it depends on how these things are set up. And certainly, again, putting the disclosures out there to the public to show what is, in fact, behind. I mean, I guess I can say there are good actors in this space who are demonstrating that they are, in fact, backing their stablecoins, their tokens, and that they are, engaged where you can actually hold the peg and that people are actually getting the value out of them. And certainly for DeFi operations, stablecoins are essential. So I think it really is definitely getting some of that out. I know, though, that big debate is around, what the role of banks in this. And so that is definitely a dynamic that Congress is going to weigh in on.
So, Kathy, I do wonder about something like crypto and or blockchain, that it could really crisscross a lot of walks of our world. So who needs to oversee it? Or is there going to have to be a couple of major departments within the federal government that have to oversee it, or in the regulatory side of our government?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'd say it really is a whole-of-government approach. I mean, there were things that the president's executive order demonstrated, that there are facets of this that affect certainly national security and financial crime, and then you look at all of the use cases for what blockchain can bring to any ledger process or transaction process. And you think about healthcare and transportation and supply chain. And so there are definitely a lot of different applications for the technology and things that need to be thought about here. But certainly as it comes to financial services, if you're engaged in this financial product space, you have kind of the existing regulators that are coming to bear, and I think they're all working through how they can coordinate better.
Yeah.
And that's something I would encourage, because you are going to have different regulators, there's no doubt about it, who have a role, but it's how they coordinate together and then send that clear message to the industry,
right,
about what the rules are.
Well, okay, Kathy, one thing I've been thinking about in addition to algorithmic stablecoins a lot is utility here when it comes to crypto. And I guess, and I ask this question all the time, because I think with the carnage that we've seen over the last few months, $2 trillion in wealth just completely wiped out. And billionaires lost money, but some people, normal people, lost everything. And I wonder about utility here beyond speculation. Sell us on the utility of this technology.
So this is something that is definitely something that's been asked about over and over again. I mean, the blockchain technology really is secured by the token and mining and all of that mechanics, and that's where the digital asset markets are based. And so people are saying, what is this in the future? I'd say it's, again, all of the use cases that we were just talking about are frankly, they don't come without the tokens and the digital asset markets. And so that's the part that will be interesting to see. So many parallels to the 90s and even with, even you mentioned Terra with the 2000.com burst, bubble burst then. But I would say it's really incumbent on the industry to move together smartly and start demonstrating all of the things that will be built on this, and the fact that we're operating with integrity, that we're providing disclosures and clarity and transparency.
Right.
And, that's where companies like Solidus Labs come in, too, is we're really pushing market integrity.
Right, right. And certainly in terms of surveillance and monitoring. Kathy Kraninger, she's former director of the Consumer Protection Financial Bureau and vice president of regulatory affairs at Solidus Labs, joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. As for Bitcoin right now, $23,000, $131. It's moving around fast.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We just have about 10 and a half minutes left in today's Friday trading session, so we're getting ready to wrap up the day and the week. We're just coming off our lows of the session. I'm looking at the last 5 days. I mean, we've had quite a rally underway this week.
Yeah, we have. Look at that. And even the month, Carol, we're up 5% this month on the S&P 500, even with being down more than 1%
today. You don't have to be afraid to open up your 401k soon, maybe.
Maybe. I mean, we're still sub 40, 4,000
okay,
in the S&P.
That.
Let's get into it with Michael Sheldon. He's Executive Director and Chief Investment Officer at Hightower RDM Financial Group, joining us on the phone from Westport, Connecticut. Michael, good to have you back with us. How are you?
Good. Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, so tough year, 2022 so far, but we've still got a few months left. We've wrapped up the first half of the year. Here we are in month 7 at this point. Give us an idea of where you're seeing opportunities right now, because a lot of people we talk to say, hey, the choppiness, this is going to continue.
Yeah, well, this week was, looking back this week, there were some encouraging signs, I think, although it's still a little early to signal the all clear. Some things we were watching this week was high beta stocks outperformed low volatility stocks, below investment grade bonds, so the credit side of things perked up a little bit. We saw some better performance in semiconductor stocks and consumer discretionary stocks. So those are all positive signs. And for the first time since the market high in January, we saw more than 90% of stocks on the NYSE have a positive day. So that was on Tuesday. So those are definitely some encouraging
signs. Carol was off that day. Is there any correlation there?
I'll leave that to the others.
It is true. When I'm away, usually it's when the markets sell off. So I don't know what happened on that day. No, but Arkriti Gupta talked about it earlier in the week, right? When we see market moves, a thin market or a little participation, either direction tells us one thing. But when we see a broadening of breadth to the upside or downside, that tells us something significantly. And we saw a broadening of breadth to the upside this week, and that's a positive.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But I think you also have to look at the weight of the evidence. So we're still dealing with a lot of macroeconomic uncertainty. The yield curve is inverted right now, so that's a spread between 2-year and 10-year notes. Unfortunately, that inversion has historically led to weaker economic data. The dollar continues to be fairly strong, and that's a headwind for U.S. companies. A lot of companies are mentioning the dollar in the reports. And weekly jobless claims have started to trend higher after reaching, I think it was the lowest level in 55 years last year.
Yep.
So we still face some macroeconomic headwinds. I think as we go through earnings season, so far things look okay. Starting the second quarter earnings season, earnings estimates were for about a 4% increase, and now we're at about 4.8%. So that's pretty good. And more importantly, looking ahead to 2023, coming into this quarter, the earnings estimates for next year were about roughly 9.4%. Today we're at 8.7%. So we are starting to see some of the earnings estimates come down, but not as much as you would expect, considering the uncertainty we're facing.
So, Michael, what are the reasons why it's still too early to signal the all clear? Is it because of things that you just mentioned, including those weekly jobless numbers coming up for the 3 weeks in a row?
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. consumer represents about 2/3 of the overall economy, so it's really important to sort of have your pulse on what's going on for the consumer. So far this year, the U.S. economy has generated about 475,000 jobs per month, and that's a pretty good number. However, weekly jobs claims, as I mentioned earlier, are starting to drift higher, and that indicates, you know, you've heard comments from a number of technology companies that they're starting to either reduce their hirings or lay some workers off. And another thing we watch, which is more leading, is the leading economic indicator, which came out this week, and that's declined in five of the past six months. And the reason that's important, it tends to sort of forecast the direction of the economy looking ahead over the next few quarters. So right now the Fed is laser-focused on reducing inflation, and as long as it does that, we're likely to see somewhat weaker economic growth before things ultimately turn around when inflation peaks and starts to come down.
When inflation peaks, Carol?
Yeah.
That's the question, right?
Well, and the thing is, you know, help me out here historically. I think I've been reading some things that talked about that once inflation does start to come down, it kind of comes down rather quickly. Are you anticipating that that's what we see? Because I think there is also some concerns that, you know, the Fed is going to end up being too aggressive and maybe overdoing it. But it's not, you know, an exact game or exact science here, right, when it comes to rate moves and the impact on inflation and how quickly it comes down.
Well, that's a challenging thing for investors and for the markets right now. We are starting to see some signs that inflation is peaking. I mean, right now inflation, the CPI number is at about 9.1%, which is the highest level since 1981. So we're at 40-year highs. So a lot of investors in the market today haven't seen this kind of inflation. But I think we're starting to see some signs that inflation may be peaking. For example, the job market is starting to soften a little bit. Commodity prices are starting to come down, whether you look at things like copper, lumber, steel. And the housing market is also showing signs of slowing. Freight rates overseas for shipping goods are starting to soften. So you put this all together, and it seems likely that we should start to see softer inflation data as we head through the fall.
Well, What about peak inflation here? We just heard from Steve Matthews in our Atlanta Bureau, and he's got this survey of Bloomberg economists who are essentially saying that, okay, expect a 75 basis point rate hike next week, but then we're going to start to see the Fed put the brakes on a little bit. Do you think we're going to see a cut in 23?
You know, it's interesting. You hear more and more economists actually calling for a peak in rates at the end of December. So that means, as you said, we're likely to, when the Fed meets next week, we're likely to see another 75 basis points in increase. So that would leave short-term rates at about 2.5%. And then we have three more meetings. So we could have a half-point increase in September. That means 3%. And then maybe two more quarter-point rate hikes in the last 2 months of the year, which would leave rates at about 3.5%. At that point, I mean, that's an eternity from now, looking at the markets. But at that point, we could very well be in for a pause. It sort of depends a lot on the incoming economic data.
Right.
And the Fed has continued to say they're monitoring the data.
Yeah, I feel like this is going to be an important meeting in terms of if we do see Jay Powell starting to talk down, that maybe, you know, they could be a little bit less aggressive. But we will know in about 5 days' time from now. Hey, Michael Sheldon, thank you. Executive Director, Chief Investment Officer at Hightower RDM Financial Group, joining us once again on the phone from Westport, Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.